This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the U.S. retail sales growth rate be greater than 1.5% in June of 2025? The yes forecast contract recently traded 11% and the no was at 87%. With Interactive Brokers forecast contracts, you can trade on future events like climate change, the economy, or politics. You choose yes or no. And if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Explore trending data on all sorts of areas, spot the trends, and make your prediction for June 2025. Trade forecast contracts, Interactive Brokers, and earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon, and you get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. The last trading for this contract is July 17th.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Aha! The OBA is signed into law. Letters are going out with new deadlines for tariffs, and we're coming up on earnings season. JP Morgan, in fact, reporting on the 15th next week, and our guest, Larry McMillan, the options strategist. All this and much more on episode number 929 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Great hello to you. Welcome to another episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host, the founder of Horowitz & Company, an investment advisory firm right here downtown Fort Lauderdale, where actually our studios are also located, where we produce this show and DH Unplugged each and every week for the last, I think it's 17 years or so, which we love doing. So what's been going on? A flurry, I think it's a flurry, of stuff. This whole the crazy chaotic manner that we're getting used to, aren't we, though? It seems that the VIX has been rather complacent. We'll talk about that a bit. We saw that the OBA, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, we have to have an acronym. There's actually, I think, a chief of acronyms for the U.S. government. Somebody that says, you know, no matter what bill, whatever legislation we have, whatever happens, the legislation has to have an acronym. And that's the acronym for this, OBA. You're going to hear it time and time again. Now, it was signed into law last week, and now we have to, well, figure it out. The idea that there is no tax on tips, not exactly true. No tax on Social Security, definitely not true. No tax on overtime, not true either. Yes, we have some things like all babies that are born seem to have a new account with $1,000 that's going to put into them. We have to figure out how that goes. Only till 2028. A lot of these things that have been put into this legislation are only until 2028. Then they have to be voted on, etc. Obviously, why 2028? You know why. It's all political. It's all for the face value of, hey, look what we got during our tenure. And if you want to go back and vote against this by not renewing it, well, you're doing a big disservice, and who knows what party is going to be in power in the next term. So that's a big issue right now. So we looked at a lot of different measures that could be impactful. Some are, some aren't. Like the deduction you get for the tips, it's not, again, it's not no tax, it's a deduction. $25,000 maximum, depending on where your income is, between $150,000 and $300,000, depending on if it's you're single or married. There's a deduction there. Only part is excluded. There's a maximum household threshold. But the good news is that if you are a service worker and or get tips somehow, some way, the potential is, depending on your income level, let's say you're about earning $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, you could be getting about a $28,000 to $3,000 tax savings over the next number of years. Pretty good. And the better part of that, really cool, is that it's retroactive to 2025 tax year. So this tax year, even though it was voted in now, you don't have to wait till 2026. In other words, when you file your 2025 in 2026, you're going to get the tax break. So you don't have to wait a whole year. Very cool. Overtime workers will see some benefit as well. Not as much. And a friend asked me, oh, mate, wait, you know what? Second. I put this on Twitter, by the way. My handle is Andrew Horowitz, one word. If you want to follow me, at Andrew Horowitz on Twitter. He asked me, he said, you know, well, do we tip less now? Kind of an interesting question. Because, you know, those machines that come to you that we get after our meal that automatically puts 22% on no matter what you buy, or in fact, if you do a takeaway or, you know, a delivery, you should be giving all this money to, even though they get a fee for it. Okay, whatever your choice is, whatever you want to do, whatever your level of generosity is, maybe the new tip should be, I don't know, 13% is the new 18% because it's not taxable. Now, that what would that would do? And he said to me, well, you know, think about it for a second. If we tip less, and again, that's only a small amount of money, but if we tip less, there's more money in our pocket, we can go and spend it in the economy. If we give it to the food service worker, I'm like, uh-huh. Well, then they get to spend it because they have less taxes due sometime in the future on whatever they're spending it on. How about I make the choice of where I want to put my money to work? I'm like, okay, if that's what you're going to do, that's how it works. I don't know. The interesting thing about that line of questioning and that line of thinking is that that is what is going to have to be anticipated through economists. That's their job. They got to figure out all these different variables inside of these kind of laws. And the fact is, it probably wasn't done ahead of time. We don't know exactly the impact of how this is going to play out. Is it going to be on higher end items, paying down credit card, putting into savings? Who is going to actually be spending the money or not that is saved from this? Something that's really interesting to think about. I think the question was kind of silly, and I told him, but nonetheless, the exercise in that line of questioning is pretty fascinating because we really do not know when you push a little bit over here, what bulges over there. You know, the butterfly effect, right? Where a butterfly could flap its wings in Asia and it creates a storm in South Africa. That's the kind of thing that we're dealing with here. We do not know the impact of how this is going to actually play out long term. Something that we're going to have to watch. Now, earnings season is right around the corner. I think JP Morgan is going to be reporting on the 15th. That's next week. Yeah, JP Morgan is going to be reporting next week. And that's what the official kickoff is to earnings season these days. It used to be Alcoa when that was important, but they're not. Now, according to FactSet, I did some digging in to see what was going on. During the second quarter, the outlook that we're going to find coming out right now, analysts reduced earnings per share estimates by a wider margin than usual. Now, this is a bottoms-up EPS estimate for quarter two, which means that we look at each of the various companies in the S&P 500, we look at their earnings and then per share, and then we add it up and then divide it by the appropriate level of the way that the construction of the S&P 500 is, and you come out with a number, right? This aggregation of EPS forecasts for all companies, the median fell by 4.2%, dropping from 65.55 in March to 62.83. That was the last number. So we got a 4% drop. Now, markets don't seem to care. Hitting on all-time highs, even a little tariff didn't bother anybody when the letters went out. You know, the bottom line here is that when you look at what went on, with the recent rally that we saw, it really doesn't have to do with anything more than, at this point, hope for the future. Because if you look at where we are with regard to the earnings estimates, well, they're down. Now, it's common, by the way, for analysts to lower EPS estimates during a quarter. And that seems to happen a lot because they want companies to reach that bar, it seems. But this particular quarter's decline stands out. When you look at the past 20 quarters, which is 5 years, the average quarterly decline in bottoms-up EPS estimates has been only 3%. Over the past years, 3.1% over the past 15 years, 3.2%. Now, when you look at the past 20 years, 80 quarters worth of data, estimates, etc., the average was actually 4.2%. So basically, the second quarter reduction in EPS estimates, it exceeded the 5, 10, and 15-year averages. I'm not sure what exactly that means per se. Does that mean that, well, on one hand, what we're looking at is that we're getting more of a reality check here? Or are we saying, well, you know, it's more in line with the long-term average? I guess you could look at that a lot of different ways. But right now, we did see a larger than usual rate earnings analysis estimate cut without a commensurate stock market drop into it. Which means, by the way, this is important, that earnings season may be setting up to be a disappointment. That's the point you want to really look at. If the earnings estimates were reduced and companies don't meet those higher levels by a substantial measure because their stocks are already at a peak level, that could be problematic for many companies. Now, I want to talk about one other thing. Let's talk about rate cut probabilities, shall we? You know, after that recent unemployment report that we saw last week, where it dropped to 4.1%. And we saw, generally speaking, a better overall employment report, right? The probability of a 25 basis point cut in July meeting is 4.7% versus 21% a week ago. The probability of a 25 basis point cut or a quarter basis point cut in September meeting, still about the same, 65 versus 68. October goes to 41 versus 74%. And December goes from 93% down to 74%. So a huge change in expectations for rate cuts. And that is in line also with the very, I would say, stubborn, Jay Powell and crew, who say, you know what, it's really not time to do so. We don't know how the impact of tariffs are going to affect inflation, PCE, and other areas of the economy. There was a report last week during Prime days, the Amazon Prime days, that said that on average, there was about a 4.5% increase in most prices during this season compared to last. That's still a drop when you look at the Amazon products that I think mandate a 20% reduction in overall pricing compared to their average price or their normal price. There still was an increase of about 4%. But the high-end pricing, this is where it really got interesting. There was anywhere from a 5 to a 15% increase in overall pricing over the last year in the higher-end products. So we're starting to see that this little bit of volatility in pricing is starting to creep in, probably due to a year later, some inflation that's been already in the system, and the impact of tariffs, or the perception of the increase of tariffs, or better yet, the fact that companies are saying, the hell with it, we're just going to raise prices because, well, we got the cover of tariffs. That who's going to get upset with that? So just think about that. Something interesting. One of the things I also was looking at recently was the VIX. I talked about that a little bit. We're going to talk about that with our guest because he's the option strategist. And the VIX is an option that you could utilize, right? It's a VIX futures, but you really could play it probably the purest way through options. We're going to get to that. First, let's talk about Interactive Brokers for a minute, because if you want to navigate political uncertainty, well, disciplined investors, they don't panic. We prepare. At Interactive Brokers, you can help protect your portfolio and hedge market risks with bonds, precious metals, and foreign exchange, all from one powerful platform. With advanced tools, global access, and low costs, IBKR helps you manage volatility and stay ahead, even in uncertain times. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. To learn more, visit IBKR.com/navigate. Let me give it a quick intro to our guest before we get to him. Larry McMillan. He's a professional trader, perhaps best known as the author of Options as a Strategic Investment, the best-selling work on stock and index strategies, which has sold over more than 300,000 copies. He's an active trader on his own account. He also manages option-oriented accounts for some individuals. In a research capacity, he edits and contributes to his firm's publication, Dalium Volume Alerts, The Option Strategist, and The Daily Strategist. Derivative product newsletters covering equity, index, and future options. Finally, he speaks on option strategies in many seminars all over the world, United States, Canada, Europe. He gets to travel. And he's been all over TV. He's been all over TV, in radio, podcast. You've seen his writings. You've seen him somewhere. So I'm interested. I have a lineup of questions. So, Larry, how are you?
I'm doing great, Andrew. Things are, you know, summer.
<It's> good, right? Yeah, exactly. Nice time of year. And we have great things happening, which we're going to get into, like the VIX is low and there's some complacency, or at least something's going on. And, you know, we have organized chaos. But I want to back up. I want to ask you. So I don't think I've ever asked you. What was, you know, there's different strokes for different folks. People, you know, some people like the buy and hold methodology of investing. Some people like trading. Some people love the futures market, the currency markets. You know, a lot of people, newbies, always seem to be really enthralled with the currency market. But what first drew you into the world of options trading?
Well, actually, it's kind of funny. I was in grad school at the University of Colorado, and the Denver Broncos used to sell a certain number of tickets to the public. You had to stand in line to get them. So I went down to standing in line. I always joked that line was a mile high and a mile long. Anyway, so to pass some time, I jumped into a bookstore, grabbed a book called How to Make a Million. Well, it turned out it was a really, despite the frivolous title, it was actually a serious book about convertible arbitrage, or convertible bonds anyways. And so that was my first experience with derivatives, and, you know, kind of really struck me, you know, something I liked. And then the CBOE opened the next year. So I was pretty much on board right from the beginning. And I don't know, I really understood option strategies just sort of inherently. So I just stuck with that.
So how were the Broncos that year?
They were okay. You know, nothing great. Yeah. Going way back, I think Frank Shapuka was their quarterback.
Wow. Going back. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned this. It jogs my memory. I remember one time I was somewhere and I was like, oh, maybe I'll think about investing as something, right? I'll do it. And I got a book. And the reason I got the book was because I didn't exactly understand what the title meant at all. But it looked kind of thin. I was like, all right, I'll start with that. It was something called the TED spread. And it was something, I don't know if you know that, it's something about currency spread. I don't remember even what it was. As a matter of fact, when I read it, I thought it was very interesting to a point that I'm like, all right, well, I don't really get this, but it's kind of interesting how you could do this. It was another arbitrage book, right? How do you do this currency thing and all that? Well, maybe I'll look at that. I think it had to do with the 10-year and the dollar and some other currencies. But
I vaguely remember it myself, but I couldn't tell you what it was.
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of interesting. So that then took you into the world of directly into options trading, or what? You started working at the CBOE?
No. I was working at, well, I was in grad school at that time. Then when the CBOE opened, I was working at Bell Labs. I was a programmer. So I started my own newsletter. I used to have some interesting subscribers, one of whom was Ivan Boesky.
Really?
Yeah. So I just advertised it in Barron's and it got, you know, some subscribers. And then about 4 years later, and a position opened up at my brokerage firm, which was Thompson McKinnon, for an option strategist. So then I left Bell Labs and went to Wall Street then.
Back then, you had to, I'm guessing here, and I know I'm right, but you had to calculate this stuff by hand, all the different variations of the strategies.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was a programmer. I did have access to the Bell Labs computer, so I was doing a lot of Black-Scholes modeling and all that stuff back then even. It was, you know, the Black-Scholes model came out right about the same time the CBOE opened. So I was able to, do theoretical values, compute implied volatilities, all that sort of stuff. which was in those days considered really advanced.
Yeah. And then not only that, you didn't have the, I don't think you don't, you didn't have the liquidity like you have today to really hone in on the valuation models, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. And I didn't have a pricing service either. So I had to type the prices in by hand.
I love that. I love that. How did you get pricing?
There weren't that many.
But how did you get pricing?
So, and then just take it out of the Wall Street Journal. You know, there were only in the beginning 16 stocks with options, and that went to 32. You know, then it started to increase after that, but it still wasn't all that many. You could, especially if you were just, you know, if you were ignoring the deep out of the monies, you could type in all the at the money stuff pretty quickly. I'd say less than a half an hour or so.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of interesting. So, your name is synonymous with option strategy, but you're telling me that before that, you basically, well, there was no really before that, was there? You were kind of, you cut your teeth on the career that you're doing now. I mean, you've have you ever thought of maybe, oh, the hell with these options? I want to trade, I don't know, I want to trade some currencies.
Yeah, no, that never really attracted me. I never was a floor trader. I was always an upstairs trader. And there's just, you know, there's a lot of option opportunities in general. So I never really felt like I was missing out on anything.
Do you remember your first options trade ever?
Worst or first?
Well, we'll start with first, which was my question, but maybe we'll work our way into that one.
Yeah. But early on, I remember I think I was just, you know, buying some calls on Kodak or something. But then I started to do some put ratio spreads or call ratio spreads. We didn't have puts back then, just calls. I did some call ratio spreads, which I got a little too cute. And I had naked calls. And then the market shot up after the October 74 bottom. So I got burned a little bit on that. That was actually probably one of my worst trades.
That's a good lesson, though, right? I bet.
Yeah, yeah, oh, absolutely.
Always is. I mean, I remember, I can remember a bunch of bad trades. I mean, I remember a trade on a couple, well, today it's called MicroStrategy still, but this is back in 2000. I remember this, and I was like, oh, that was bad. It was just cut in half overnight, and I realized I was in too heavy, and this, and kind of set the stage for some deeper analysis and making sure that you have proper money management disciplines going into this, you know? So
right.
You've authored one of the most well-respected books in the field. It's called Options as a Strategic Investment. And did you expect it to become such a staple? I mean, what inspired you to write it first? And did you really, I mean, I don't know. I've written two books. I never thought it was going to be like, oh my God, these, you know, crazy runaway fictional, somebody's going to write a movie based on my book, right?
Yeah. You know? But, well, when I, as I said, I went to Wall Street to be the option strategist for Thompson McKinnon. And part of that job was writing a weekly letter. So I was just explaining strategies for the brokers, you know, put ratio, call ratio spreads, call buying, covered writing, you know, various things like that. And each issue was, came out like once a week. Anyways, the New York Institute of Finance was looking for a book on option strategies, and they happened to ask the president of the CBOE, who was Jim Dalton at the time, and he said, well, I don't know this guy, but he's writing about strategies he seems to know what he's talking about over at Thompson McKinnon. So they approached me, and I submitted a very long outline for the book, and they said, all right, well, let's do this. And so that was 78.
Wow.
And the book came out at the end of 79. I mean, they put a 1980 copyright date on it
just to freshen it up.
What's that?
Just to freshen it up and make it look modern.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that was the first edition. You know, it's probably 250 pages or so. And they really sold it. I mean, they spent a lot of time marketing it. And then New York Institute of Finance was eventually bought by Prentice Hall, and they continued to market it. And now it's owned, I think, by Pearson. But they still continue to market it. You know, it's some publishers really just publish books, and some people, Some of them sell books. Yeah, that's a big difference.
So, Ken, I just want to continue on because I think it's fascinating. What was there a turning point in your career that it was like this, something that changed the trajectory or your mindset and what you were doing that really catapulted you?
Well, I don't know. I guess it, when the options first came out, it was trading some, you know, I had some success, but although, like you said, theoretical values weren't doing you much good. I don't think they still really do you all that much good. It's now it's all relative stuff. but, you know, I really felt that it was potentially a much more lucrative career than being a programmer. I don't know if that's really true or not, but there wasn't anything around it at that time, like Apple or Microsoft to be a programmer for. So, you know, so I concentrated on that. And then, you know, once I got to Wall Street, I eventually ended up trading the house account, the proprietary account, which was very lucrative for pretty much all of us.
Mm-hmm. And when you say you were programming, what language was back there? Was it COBOL? Was it, what was it?
Now, Bell Labs had invented C by that time. Oh. It just was new. So we were programming in C and the Unix operating system, which never did really take off.
I programmed in C sharp. It's all about where you put the semicolon, isn't it? You know, just put it in the right spot. You're halfway there.
Right.
All right.
When I went to Wall Street, they didn't have Unix or C, but we still managed to get some programs done in Fortran.
So you mentor, you train, you've taught, you trade, you write, there's a lot of things that you do, right? But give me what it looks like in the world of options trading. I'm talking about trading now. And what does a typical day look like? Where does it begin? Where does it end? And what happens a bit in between? You can leave out the lunch break.
Yeah. Well, so I have a set of criteria that I look at pretty much every day in terms of some theoretical values. For example, I like straddle buying. There hasn't been a lot of opportunity for that recently, but I'll check that. We, on our website, we crunch all kinds of numbers every night. And in a lot of cases, we just put the outputs of all of our data analysis up on the website. So, you know, that straddle buys are there. I'm pretty much a large seller of naked options, especially puts. So I'll look for those. You know, where they just seem to be really skewed and out of line. You know, again, sort of a theoretical value thing. The option straddle buying is also theoretical value. And then, as far as speculation, I'll look at put call ratios. That's a contrary indicator that has a pretty good track record, especially for individual stocks. So, again, on a given day, you may not even find any of these. You know, it's not like I'm trading a million things a day, but we did just have a buy signal in Apple based on the put call ratio. People have gotten pretty pessimistic on Apple, and we're buying a lot of puts over the last few weeks, and that forced the put call ratio up to a really high level, the same level it was at about a year ago, and then there was a really good rally after that by the stock. So.
So what came first, though? Was it the reality of the put-call ratio that just was concurrent with the fact that it was oversold or underloved or underappreciated? Or maybe was it the fact that all these put-call ratio watchers, you know, sophisticated investors in the market, saw this and then said, well, it's time.
Yeah. You never know. And that's the one thing about, you know, data or technical analysis. I like to use, you know, strategies, or if you're using technical analysis, things that make sense, just like you said, if that other people are seeing the same thing and acting on it, because it certainly doesn't hurt to have other people doing the same thing you're doing at the same time, especially if it's big money. So yeah, that is definitely a possibility. So just because there's a put call ratio say, extreme pessimism or something, I won't really just jump in there and buy it until the stock begins to turn and I see that there's actually people starting to buy this stock. Then I'll move in. You know?
Right, because it's just like it's like the 50-day moving average. You know, what's the importance of the 50-day moving average? Absolutely nothing, but for the fact that other people look at it too.
Right.
And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that everybody believes that the first stop of an institutional investor of a stock that they own and love will be to buy more on the 50-day moving average. That's just and then the 200-day or maybe the 150 or the 100, pick what you want. But what's the importance of those lines? Nothing, except that maybe there is when you talk about the big money, the institutions are actually programmed, for better or for worse, for no reason, to buy on the 50-day moving average, a stock they're going to hold forever.
Right.
So just follow along. Follow along.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, some of the old patterns they would talk about, like flags and all that, doesn't make any sense to me, really, because nobody else is really watching for that. But, like if you said, if you see an indicator that other people are paying attention to, then, you know, behooves you to pay attention to it as well.
Unless you're like an IBD, you know, you look at Investors Business Daily.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you're a big proponent of, let's say, the cup and handle. You know, watch for the cup and handle. It's got to be this. Okay, it's a buy. And then all those people that are following Investors Business Daily, looking at the top 100 stocks, top 50 stocks, say, oh, that stock just hit the cup and handle. We're going to buy. You know, reach the point. Or, you know, you have the momentum crowd that's just buying no matter what. Right? It doesn't matter. Or they're selling no matter what. But the put selling is interesting to me. Because I'm gonna ask you something. Is the idea that most of the people are mispricing the puts because there's too much potential anxiety or concern, and the fact is that markets generally move from bottom left to top right over time, generally speaking?
Well, yeah, and you know, institutions over the years have now understood that buying puts is a good form of insurance, but they tend to overpay for it. So I'm looking for cases where they're overpaying. Typically, they overpay for, Spire or SPX insurance. That's the number one thing they overpay for. But then it does spread out to individual stocks as well.
Now, do you do options on futures?
I do, yeah.
That's where the fun begins, right?
Right. Yeah, there's been a delist of a lot of futures in recent years. So you don't really have orange juice futures anymore or lumber futures and things that I used to, you know, make some decent money on. I mean, you still got, of course, the S&P futures. That's just like SPX, same thing.
But the thing I never understood about options on futures is that there is not a similar timing of the opening of the markets. Futures trade 24/7 technically during the week, right? Option close when markets close, right? Like 4 o'clock. So you have all this empty time of anxiety, as I would see it at least.
They've been, so now, like, for example, though, at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where they're trading the S&P futures, the options trade all the time, too.
Is that liquidity?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, something bad happens overnight, you can adjust your positions or whatever. Hmm. But even the CBOE now is trading SPX options starting at 3 in the morning. Because they realize that, you know, for these foreign traders, Europeans especially, want to trade at that time if there's a reason for it. Although I wouldn't say the SPX options that trade on the CBO are all that liquid at 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
But they do trade.
I've stayed away from purposefully things that trade all night because I've done it before. And I got to tell you something. I sleep with one eye open. And I'm like, all right, I might as well get up and do something here. You know? And then you just start doing like, oh, look at gold. Let me put a little trade in that, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Often said in my lectures, if whatever strategy you're using is causing you to lose sleep at night, then find a new strategy.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go into the VIX because the VIX is kind of interesting. This is July. I think you mentioned in a discussion we had that you know, July is a seasonal period that becomes a kind of a interesting time for the VIX, usually a seasonal low. VIX under 17 lately, with all the chaos that's going on, by the way, fascinating to me. I truly fascinating. What's your current
outlook? They're just not all that concerned with tariffs, I guess.
They're not concerned with tariffs. They're not concerned with bunker-busting bombs. They're not concerned with putting more warheads and stuff into the hands of the Zelensky. They're not concerned about the Middle East. They're not concerned about anything.
Yeah.
What is that about? What's your current outlook on this? What's, you know, how are you positioning around it?
Right. So, like you said, VIX typically has a yearly low right around in June. It used to be right around the first, July. It used to be right around the 1st of July, but now it kind of extends through the whole month. But by August, things start to pick up. And I've always said that, you know, when VIX is low, that's not the sign to sell. It's when it starts to jump up from having been low, that's the time to sell. And so we're watching for that to happen.
You're talking about sell the calls?
Sell the market, you know.
Oh, sell the market. So with the VIX on, let's kind of pretend, let's do a pretend trade here, shall we? The VIX at, what's going to be about, use round numbers for the heck of it. The VIX at 17. Now, if you were thinking that, okay, it's going to pick up, would you do something like, what are we in July? Would you pick up in August something or other VIX at 20? Would you do it on a call side? Would you look to... say, okay, well, no, I'm going to buy right at the money. What's your better trade on that? I know it's all about the numbers and all of, I get that. I'm talking about generally.
Right. So VIX is interesting. You really need to stay fairly short term because there's a steep term structure in the VIX futures, which is what the options are based off of. So you can have, if you buy a 6-month VIX and VIX explodes now, that 6-month future is not going to go up very much. But the 2-week one will definitely be exploding. So what I usually say is you really want to speculate in VIX. You only go out, you know, to the next month and probably about 33% out of the money. That, therefore, you're not spending a fortune on these calls. But when something happens, your calls are definitely going to kick in.
Yeah, what you said, if it's at 17 and we go 33%, you don't want to go over 22. Approximately, I'm just round number
22-23 in that area, you know. And right now, you're still in July. There are weekly VIX options, so they're maybe not as liquid as the other ones, but they do exist. So you know, you might buy like an end of the month of July, and then a couple, you know, or I mean, going all the way out to August right now is not terrible, but it's a little bit longer than I would.
Right, maybe the weekly's in August. The first weekly in August, but not for us. So is this, so when do you get your trigger though on this? I mean, if the VIX is in this, I think we both agree this, it seems like the VIX is underrating the risk out there. Am I wrong? Well, maybe it's not. Maybe the fact is, it is what it is. I don't know. Depends on how you look at it, right?
I mean, like 2006 market, the VIX was, I think, went all the way to 10. 2016, 2019, you know, very low for a long period of time. That's what I'm saying. The one thing I kind of watch is the 200-day moving average. If VIX jumps above the 200-day moving average, then it could be interesting. But until it really does that, it's just dull, you know. So I wouldn't be getting too heavily speculating into long VIX calls as long as it's below its 200-day moving average. But once VIX crosses above the 200-day and also the 20-day crosses above the 200-day, that's usually a pretty good sell signal for the market, buy signal for VIX.
So are there any sectors or any particular asset classes where you're seeing that there's an unusually higher low implied volatility right now?
Yeah, that we look for that too. I'm not seeing much of anything. They're all relatively low, but I don't see anything that's really, you know, standing out, you know, as far as, you know, individual stocks. I mean, I mentioned Apple, that's sort of I wouldn't say all the rest of the Fantastic Seven or whatever you want to call them are, great buys on a option basis, but Apple is, and, you know, we look at those are easy ones to, you know, to analyze. But I, you know, no, I'm not really seeing a sector that's contributing right now.
So when you look at the overall market, or you look at the market of a particular stock, there's two different things, right? It's either the markets or the stocks. And I'm not talking about futures, but you mentioned a put-call ratio. So as a contrary indicator. So can you kind of walk us through for, you know, pretend all of us listening have no clue what you're talking about here. We understand there's a call. We understand there's a put. We understand what those do. But can you understand this put-call ratio and what it means in terms, and how to read it, and what to look for?
Okay. Well, I'll give you a little history on it. The put-call ratio as an indicator was invented by Marty Zweig all the way back in the 1950s. And he was getting the option volume out of the broker-dealer ads that ran in Barron's every Sunday. And so he thought originally that he would go with the volume. Quickly found out that there was a lot of calls being traded over the counter. It was all over the counter back then. A lot of calls as compared to puts, the market went down. And vice versa, there's a lot of puts traded as compared to calls, the market went up. So he realized it was a contrary indicator. So that's held true all throughout. So it's just now become a matter of how do you interpret that. We prefer the dollar-weighted put-call ratio, which is where you take the option price times its volume, and that's how many dollars are being spent on that option. That seems to be the most accurate indicator to me. And in terms of individual stocks, we look for it to get really extreme. And by you can tell the extremes if you just look at a chart. So like I mentioned, Apple. So it got up to a pretty high level, and you know, now it's rolled over. Like the, you know, the put buyers have sort of exhausted themselves, and the put call ratios begin to roll over and start to head down again. And that's the buy signal for the stock. So that's how it works.
So it's like a V, are you using like a VWAP of it? Is it like a volume weighted price? That's the point. So that you're saying instead of just the price, you're saying, I want to see actually how much, not only volume, but what's my real commitment? Yes. What's the real commitment?
Exactly. Because, you know, if people come in and they're buying a lot of cheap, way out of the money options for a few cents, that doesn't mean nearly as much as if somebody's coming in and buying a bunch of at the money options and spending some real, real money there.
Yeah.
You know, that guy's the one you probably want to see what he's doing. But it's amazing. There was a time when they were opening the various option exchanges in Europe, and they of course, the one they did immediately was trade on their index. And no matter what country it was, it turned out that the put-call ratio on the index was a great contrary indicator. It's just human nature, I guess. You know, you get all excited about buying the calls. You think the stock's going up, and you know, pretty soon you're paying top dollar for the calls, and the market turns. You know,
so who provides the put-call ratio? What service? CBOE?
So now you have, well, we calculate it ourselves. So we get we just get the raw data from mostly get ours from DTN, but you could get it from the CBOE, but that's only the CBOE data. We try to get all the option exchanges.
And then what does the numbers look like when you say, so I think isn't it above and below one?
Yeah. So one means that's an equal. So you divide you take the put calculations. So you, for each option, let's say an IBM, at the end of the day, you take the option price times the volume that traded that day, and you multiply them together, and then you add them up for all the puts. That's one number. You add them up for all the calls, you divide the two, that's the put-call ratio. So if they're equal, it's one. Typically, you know, and to me, it's a relative thing. So I can't just say that if a put-call ratio is two, you should be buying it. That's not really the case. You need to look at the chart, as I said, to see how it's behaved in the past. But with Apple, for example, you know, it had a really nice move, about a year ago, and that worked out great. I'm just going to look and see what the put-call ratio actually was at that time. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's done a really nice job of giving us some trades where you might not else otherwise be looking for trades. And it works for futures too. So, I mean, I know there was a great buy signal in cocoa last year, and the options were relatively cheap at the time. Now cocoa options are not cheap anymore.
So when you get to, when but, you get when you get to the point of whatever it is, I mean, again, it's looking at a put call ratio of, let's say, I'm just picking a number, 2. That means that there's twice as many options traded on the put side from your calculation than it is on the call side, meaning that people are pessimistic.
Right, exactly.
So the higher the number, the more pessimistic they are. The lower the number, and it can't get below 0, of course, on that. What's the highest put call ratio do you recall ever seeing?
Oh, ever? I mean, there's some crazy ones, but you have to watch out that you're not getting involved with getting mixed into an arbitrage situation. That gets distorted. You know, for like right now, yesterday, Core, we've made a bid for a small stock called CORZ, and the puts on CoreWeave are just crazy. But it's not that everybody's expecting CoreWeave to go down. They're just hedging. It's a stock-for-stock arbitrage deal, so they're just hedging the deal. So right. You know, there's some common sense involved, too.
Yeah.
So I've seen put call ratios as high as, you know, 10, 11, 12 that actually seem to make, you know, make some sense.
Earnings season is coming up next week. How do you approach that from an options standpoint?
So I have a very specific way that I like to look at these. I take there's a website called optionslam.com, which has just all kinds of data regarding earnings and what the stock did after the earnings came out. And it turns out that, you know, I'll take those, let's say, take the last 10. And you take the earnings, the post-earnings move, you can do 1 day or 3 days, whatever you want. I usually just do 1 day. And then I look at the current situation coming into the earnings. And if it's, you know, if it's low enough price that you don't have a, you know, that in the past it's moved much farther than you're looking at right now. Let's say 7 of the last 10 have moved more than that. Then I'll buy that straddle. And typically I'm out the same day, the next day, you know. So it's just a statistical thing. I mean, I'm not predicting the earnings or anything. There are sometimes ways if you see heavy option volume before the earnings, but the SEC cracked down on a lot of that stuff. So that's if you're doing that, you could get a visit from a regulator.
Oh boy. That's not good.
I'm just looking at Apple right now. This last one recorded at about 2.4. So $240 are being spent on puts for every $100 being spent on calls. So if you want to look at it.
That's like a lot.
That. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a lot.
And that was, you know, very late July, June. So that's rolled over now, and that's why we're buying it.
So in February, there was this false upside breakout, right? We're seeing that after the recent downstroke of the tariff tantrum in March, everybody's just all happy-go-lucky buying. Do we have something like that going on now? Is that in the future cards?
So I think this one right now is much more positive, much stronger. I'm seeing better readings from all the internal indicators, including put call ratios. Yeah, put call ratios are low on the index because it's been going up for, 2 months now. But they're not turning. They're still going down. As long as they're still going down, I think the market has some upside. And other things like new highs versus new lows, that just gave a new buy signal for us. And, you know, as we noted before, VIX is not rolling over and starting to rise either. So this is much stronger, I think, than the one in February.
Pretty fascinating. Again, considering all the crap that's going on. You mentioned a couple of high dividend yielding ETFs. I'm kind of curious why that was something that you thought would be an interesting thing, because it's kind of outside the bounds of what we're talking about.
Right. So we got questions because the way these are constructed, they use options. So we got questions from people about, you know, could you just do an analysis on this or that situation, you know, with the I think the first one we did was NVIDIA, So there's a covered writing strategy ETF on NVIDIA where they write cover calls, and its symbol is NVDY. You mentioned MicroStrategy. There's a good one on that, MSTY. So it's typically the same letters as the underlying with the Y on the end. Tesla has one. Coinbase has one.
And the Y stands for yield or income, either one.
It is something, I guess. You know, I don't know. It's sort of a convention at this point in time. But what these people are doing, and it started out, they were just writing cover calls and trying to use some leverage. And then these stocks went up so much that the cover calls were cutting off the profits on the upside. So they decided to do call credit spreads. So that was an interesting thing. So we explained that to people, and that's why we were analyzing them. But they pay a huge dividend. So like the MicroStrategy one, I think in the last, it's more than it's paid its entire price out as a dividend in like about 16 months.
Wow.
And so you could have bought that, 16 months ago, held it, and now you own it for free. It's taxable dividends, yes. But now you basically own it for free, and they are, it doesn't have the upside of MicroStrategy itself, but it also doesn't have the downside.
Sure.
Yeah.
So these are things to look into is if you want to maybe have some option-based strategies, but you don't want to do it yourself.
Right. And you definitely have to believe in the underlying, you got to believe in Bitcoin if you're doing MicroStrategy or Coinbase. You have to believe in NVIDIA if you're doing the NVIDIA one or Tesla, whatever. And there's one that Morgan Stanley has called JEPI, J-E-P-I. I'm not too impressed with that one. That's supposedly doing covered rights on a broad array of stocks, but it seems like there's something wrong in the performance there. It doesn't really seem to be performing as much as well as I think it should.
Interesting. Well, Larry, it's been a pleasure. All sorts of great information today. I know my listeners will look for more. We have the information on how to get in touch with Larry on the show notes for episode number 929 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And we'll make sure that people know where to find you, my friend.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Have a good summer.
All right, Andrew. You too.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, we cover so many different possible things on this show. Options, futures today, just some of them, and some great information from Larry there. So this is a guy that's a master of what he does, folks. This is the guy that wrote the book on what he does and what is used throughout the industry. So hopefully you paid attention to what was going on there. And yeah, for a lot of it is probably like, what did he say? Listen to this again. Get his book. Whatever you got to do, options are a really good play. When it comes to hedging portfolios and utilizing it inside of what you can do, as long as you understand what's going on, understand the risk and all that, but it's something at least to have in your toolbox. That's the whole point. Having it in your toolbox really gives you the benefit of the opportunity if you need to use it. So there you go. Next week coming up, Anthony Scaramucci is going to be on the show. So we're going to be looking forward to that. Probably going to be talking about Bitcoin and all sorts of crypto. And all things in between. Thank you for joining me this week and every week. I hope you're having a great summer. I'll see you again real soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.